Do you know what benefits are offered by your job? Do you know what they even mean? Or are you wondering what the differences are between being a salaried and contract SLP? Well, today I'm joined by my first male guest and husband of an SLP, Craig Goldschlager. In this episode, we discuss advice for newly graduated SLPs, the differences between being a W-2 and 1099 employee, and everything you need to know regarding your benefits.
You're listening to the Speechy Side Up podcast. This podcast will cover the flip side of traditional speech and language therapy, so you get inspired and learn from experts in the field. Here is your host, author, AAC specialist, and matcha tea lover, Vanita Litvak. She and her guests are serving up some informative and fun topics in Speechy Side Up.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Speechy Side Up podcast. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. This podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment. You can also follow along on Instagram at Speechy Side Up. All links are in the show notes. Now let's get into the show. Today, we're joined by our first male guest, Craig Goldschlager. Craig is a financial advisor who is married to an SLP named Lauren. He reached out to me after I shared the student loans episode a few episodes back, and they proposed doing an interview about financial planning advice. I ultimately agreed after having a conversation with both of them because I think it's another topic that doesn't get much attention, but I think it's very important to consider when picking a job or starting a private practice. So I'm very excited for Craig to join us today and share his financial planning tips with you. Hey, Craig.
Hey, Vanita. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you so much for coming on. Let's start by having the listeners get to know you a little bit better and how you're helping SLPs. So can you tell us about who you are, what you do today, and how you got there?
Absolutely. But before I begin, the financial services industry has a lot of rules and regulations. So just one disclosure that I'd like to add is I am affiliated with a broker-dealer by the name of Park Avenue Securities. And anything I discuss today on the show is for informational purposes only, and that individual situations may vary. So the information should be relied upon only when coordinated with individual and professional advice.
Perfect. So, thank you for sharing that.
Sure. So with that being said, I am a financial planner and the founder of a financial services firm called Utterly Financial. And we mostly and primarily focus on working with SLPs and private practice owners. So the way I got involved in this, as you mentioned in the introduction, my wife, Lauren, is a speech language pathologist. And one of her professors asked me to come to her university and give sort of a personal finance 101 seminar to graduating students. And so I did that, and I really enjoyed helping them and talking about important financial decisions. And I quickly learned that there's a lack of financial education. All the SLPs start going through your degrees in education. So from those lectures, I started networking with other private practice owners in our area where we live, and now have started speaking at national conventions, including ASHA just last month in Orlando. So primarily, my team works and helps SLPs plan for retirement and navigate other financial situations that exist along the way from completing your CF year all the way until you want to retire and perhaps no longer work.
Wonderful. And can you remind me, what was the name of the topic that you presented at ASHA recently?
Sure. So the name of the seminar was called Leaving Your Business is Inevitable. So it was recommended for private practice owners to attend because just like retirement planning or saving for individual financial goals like a house or a car, at some point every business owner does have to leave their business, myself included. And so what we talked about were the seven steps to help guide business owners and private practice owners to exit the practice on their terms, to leave the business to whom they desire, and sort of a typical timeline of what the events might look like.
Great. And I got the opportunity to speak with Lauren when we spoke last week, and we were kind of going back and forth, like, should we have Lauren on? Should we not? But you guys are expecting, like, this week, right?
Yeah. So unfortunately, the plan was for her to join, but she is I'm recording this in our house. She's upstairs right now. She thanks you again for speaking with both of us, but her mind is going a million different places. We already have one daughter, so she's taking care of our one daughter right now. So it was a bit too much.
Yeah. And being on a podcast interview when you don't really ask for it can be intimidating as well. And so when I proposed it, she was like, let me think about it. But I'm really happy to have you here, Craig, because I think you got, you know, you spoke at ASHA, you do get our field. So I'm really excited to hear about your perspective in relation to speech language pathology. So let's start by talking about the advice that you have for newly graduated SLPs.
Great. So in the presentations that I give to students, like I mentioned, that are about to enter their CF year, there's sort of six or seven high-level talking points that I always address with them. So the first one is, I believe tracking your net worth is the best indicator of your financial success and status. So a little bit more about that is, to calculate an individual or a family's net worth, it requires a little bit of math, but what you need to do is you need to add up all of your assets. So an asset is something that has monetary value. So if you think about a savings account, an investment account, the equity built up in a home. So you take the sum of your assets and you subtract your liabilities. And liabilities is a financial term for debt. So debt can include student loans, car loans, a mortgage, credit card debt. So you total up your liabilities. And once you subtract your liabilities from your assets, you're left with a number. And that number can be positive or it can be negative. And for a lot of graduating SLPs, that number can be negative, most likely because you have student loan debt, perhaps a car loan debt. But what's really important about tracking your net worth is, if that number, let's say, is negative $50,000, as you start working and as you start saving more money, you want that number to grow from negative $50,000 eventually to zero, and then eventually to being a positive number. So I think it's really important for people to track things. And by tracking your net worth and seeing that improvement, it takes time, but seeing that progress is really important.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. And I appreciate so much you using layman's terms, because my sister, I think we've talked about this, she's a financial analyst, and terms like assets and liabilities just go way over my head. But I really like how you broke that down for us. One question that I did have, and like, I'm probably the perfect person to be doing this interview because I am so clueless when it comes to this stuff. But I've told you, I recently went to the Dave Ramsey conference. Like, I'm just trying to become more knowledgeable about this. When we're talking about assets and liabilities, we're talking about total sum, right? Not like monthly.
Yes. I track it with my clients based on annual numbers.
Okay.
But depending if someone's a real go-getter, you can do this daily or weekly. There's so many tools and a lot of free tools available. Technology is great in 2019. So there's a lot of great tools. One that I can say is called Personal Capital. So I have no affiliation with them, but it's a great resource that you can use, and it helps link accounts if you're comfortable doing that. You can track your checking accounts, your savings accounts, all these different assets, as well as your liabilities. And it sort of automates the process for you, which that kind of segues into another talking point, is that I'm a big advocate of people automating as much of their financial life as possible. So once you receive your paycheck, I think that the money should be distributed automatically to many different places. So for instance, you should have money automatically sent to a savings account or an investment account or to pay off the debts. It shouldn't go directly into your checking account. The important part about putting it into a savings account is essentially you're going to pay yourself first. So what happens is, a lot of times if someone receives their paycheck from their employer and the money goes into the checking account, it usually goes right out the door, right? Whether you're going out to eat or spending it on Amazon or things like that. So if you put the if you pay yourself first and put it towards a savings account, you know that that money is earmarked for the savings, whatever the goal of the savings account is, and then you have that money left over to spend.
Yeah, great advice.
So similarly, when someone automates their life, it's important to know that as the money goes into the savings account, I'm a big believer that savings rate is much more important than investing. So building wealth means different things to different people. So maybe you are saving for a vacation, or you want to pay down your student loan debt, or you have the goal of retirement. But as you plan for these certain goals, it's important to focus on what you can control. And so certain things are out of your control when you try to invest. So the better you are putting money away, the less dependent you become on trying to catch the hottest stock in the stock market or take on a lot of risk that may not be appropriate, or you may not want to take the risk of investing in certain types of stocks. So it's important to control what you can control. And so, for instance, an example of that would be, you know that you can save 5% of your paycheck, 10% of your paycheck, whatever that amount is within your capacity.
Yeah. And is there like a particular type of savings account that you recommend, or is it just any savings account?
So, great question. I am a big advocate of having an account outside of whom you traditionally bank with. So if you're banking with a large national bank that has your checking account, I would set up a savings account somewhere else, trying to get a high interest savings rate account. So interest rates will vary based upon the stock market or bond market. But more importantly, having it outside of that large national bank, it sort of puts up a checks and balance system, because personally, as well as many of my clients, if they have a checking account and a savings account at the same bank, we'll transfer the money back and forth. Because let's say I'm $500 short this month in my checking, I might just move it into the saving from the savings. And by doing that, you're defeating the purpose of having a specific savings account for a specific goal. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of online banks as well that offer some of these higher interest checking accounts and savings accounts, but I would do that. That's a strategy that we implement a lot, because it sort of forces the true savings goal away from commingling it with your checking account.
That makes sense. And I think that's a good suggestion. You said that there were some good online ones. Do you have any recommendations for those, or just? Yeah.
Sure. So one example is a bank called Ally Bank, A-L-L-Y, and they often have very high competitive interest rates on their savings accounts. So traditionally what happens is the large bank accounts, some of the names that you're familiar with, they will often offer almost 0% interest. And one of the reasons that that's done is because they know that most people are going to leave the money where it is and not necessarily move it around to get more interest or earn more money on their money. So by taking it and putting it at one of these online banks, the online bank doesn't have to pay necessarily for the brick and mortar location. They don't have to pay for certain other expenses, so that's how they are able to pass off some of those higher interest rates to the consumer. So Ally Bank is one example of that.
Okay, is there any other ones that you recommend?
There's another one. The savings account is called Marcus. It's offered by Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Sachs is a large investment bank, but they have a personal division as well, and that account is called Marcus.
Okay, great. Yeah, like I was just thinking about my savings account. It is at the bank that I use for checking, and I think the savings is like 0.001 or like zero, you know, just like 0.01. It's very, very small. And I think we were looking at like over time how much it would be, and it's like virtually nothing. So that's a very good suggestion.
Great. Thank you. And so another topic that I'll talk about is, it's important to build credit, but you must avoid credit card debt at all costs. So I got a question for you, Vanita. Do you know what the typical credit card interest rate is if someone carries a balance?
Is it like between 15 to 18% or higher?
That's like on the lower end. I've seen them as high as 25 or even 30%.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So to put that into dollar terms, if you paid $100 towards your balance, only about 10 would go paying off the debt and the principal, and the other $90 would go towards interest.
Can you say that again? Because I think that is so significant for people to hear.
Yeah. So again, the concept of it's important to build credit, but not carry a credit card balance. Because what happens is if you charge, let's say, $1,000 on a credit card, you'll have two choices. You can either pay off the full balance of $1,000 at the end of the month, or you can pay what's called a minimum payment that is set by the credit card company. So if the credit card company says the minimum payment is $100, when you're paying something with a significantly high interest rate, and anytime you sign up for a credit card, a mortgage, an insurance policy, it's always important to read the fine print, because you'll get the nice shiny credit card, but then with it comes about a 50-page booklet of the rules and contractual obligations that you're signing up for. Mm-hmm. And so when you have that high interest rate, just giving an example, if you have that large balance and you don't pay it off at the end of the month and you pay just the minimum payment that's due, for example, if you have that balance and you make a $100 payment, if you're paying 25 to 30% interest, about $10 would go towards paying the debt back that you've taken out, and the other $90 would go towards interest, which is the credit card company earning the money.
Yeah, your money. That wasn't even something that you spent. It's just extra money that you're paying the credit card company.
Exactly. And so the next time you really want to purchase something and you don't have the cash, you always want to consider what will happen if you start revolving those balances. And so credit card debt is really dangerous, but it is important to build credit for other goals that most people aspire for. So most people want to own a home someday. And if you want to own a home, you will be rewarded for having a good credit score by having a lower mortgage rate when you do purchase a home. So the way that a lender will determine the interest rate or the mortgage rate when you purchase a home will be based primarily on something called a credit score. And when you have a credit score assigned to you, it's assigned because of about four or five major factors that determine what that number is. So it goes on a scale of about 300 to 850 being perfect, and some criteria that you need to have in order to have a better credit score include actually establishing credit history. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. You do need to take out either a credit card or an auto loan in order to build credit. But again, if you're going to do it on a credit card, you should pay off the balance in full. So that's what helps you establish credit history. So that's one important factor, building a credit history. Another one is making sure you make your payments on time. And that kind of goes back to the automating your life conversation we had a few minutes ago, where if I set my credit card payment to be paid on the first of every month through my checking account, I know that it's done. I don't risk making a late payment, and I don't get penalized with late fees or a ding on my credit history. So those are just two of the common or things that, again, talking about things you can control, two things that go into your credit score that every one of your listeners can start implementing to try and improve a credit score.
Perfect. So I'm going to summarize those. Were there any other tips or advice that you had for newly graduated SLPs before we move on?
A few more. So another one, when we're talking about savings rates, I think it's important that people live below their means and not at their means. So what I mean by that is don't spend every dollar that comes in as you earn it. I think that by paying yourself first, and if it's to start, maybe it's putting $100 away a month or $200 a month away. But by doing that, you'll build that savings rate and you'll get used to living on a lower income. So as you get an increased salary or start earning more income, it'll benefit you to know that you're building a savings rate. And then as you get more income, some of that can adjust accordingly so you can save more money. And it's just a way to improve that net worth figure that we talked about at the beginning.
Okay, perfect. So I'm going to summarize the points that you just made. So you said, you know, track your net worth, make sure that your finances are automated as much as possible. consider the savings rate and, you know, finding a savings account outside of your regular checking bank and that commercial bank that you're using. Avoid credit card debt at all costs and live below your means so that you can build up that savings and just get used to living on a lower income.
Are you looking for more high-quality therapy materials? Published materials can be pricey and take a while to arrive. Digital resources, on the other hand, can be downloaded immediately, but sometimes the quality isn't as good as you expected. I don't know about you, but I think it's so frustrating when you spend money on your materials and they're not helpful in the end. That is why Therapy Materials Vault creates low-prep and no-prep digital resources for you to download immediately. Thankfully, their resources are created by the same multidisciplinary team of therapists, so you can expect the same quality from every one of their resources. The best part is that each resource can be adapted to target multiple goals, and they're very affordable,
with the average price being $2 to $7.
Therapy Materials Vault is like the perfect combination of published and digital materials. You get the convenience of an immediate download and the streamlined and engaging content that you would expect from published materials. Visit therapymaterialsvault.com to check out their freebies and a library of English and Spanish materials. And guess what? The team at TMV also wanted to offer you a 20% discount off all activity downloads just for listening to this podcast. Use the code SpeechySideUp at checkout to get your discount and stock up on some fun and engaging materials today.
I would love to now dive into the differences between being a W-2 employee versus a 1099 contract, because I think we talked about this in our last conversation. I started out as a contracted SLP working at a charter school, and now I'm a salaried employee. So it would be really nice, especially for someone who is considering the two or even starting a private practice. What are the differences?
Great. So as you progress throughout your SLP career, you'll have those three basic types of employment to choose from. You can either be what's called a W-2 employee. The name W-2 comes from the tax document you get for being an employee of an employer. So if you do become an employee at the end of the year, you'll get that W-2 statement, which will say what your income was, what taxes were withheld, and some other important financial information. If you work for somebody or on your own terms, that's being called a 1099 or independent contractor. The 1099, again, the tax document that's produced for earning an income from someone else. So as Vanita said, you might work in a charter school, you might work for a hospital, you might know of another private practice in the area that just has an overflowing caseload and needs some extra SLPs one day a week. So if, in that example, if you're working for that private practice owner in your town one day a week, they might not hire you as an employee, but if you help them with their caseload, they'll pay you an income, and based on that income you earn, you'll be issued what's called a 1099 at the end of the year. And that's a document that gets sent to the IRS, so that way the IRS knows how much income you earned in order for you to pay the appropriate amount of taxes on that income. And then the third type of employment would be opening your own private practice, which it's great and something that many SLPs that I work with aspire for, but it is challenging to do that right out of the gates.
Absolutely. So can you talk about like the financial impacts of each of those? Like a 1099, you were saying in that case, they would need to submit their own tax information. So like that would be one of the things to consider, correct?
Correct. So as a 1099 contractor, you'll just earn the income. One of the benefits of being a 1099 contractor is that you can usually set a higher rate and earn more per hour or per client than as a W-2 employee. So if you're doing an assessment on a client and the assessment is $250, you get the $250 because you did it independently. You'll have to write your evaluation and do all of the follow-up work, but you've earned 100% of that rate. Whereas if you're working as a W-2 employee, you're most likely either salaried or you're earning a certain amount per hour, and that rate stays regardless of what the employer charges the client. So if the employer is charging the client $80 an hour, but your hourly pay is $40 an hour, then that other $40 goes to the employer. And that's one of the benefits of being an employer or owning a private practice someday, is that you can have SLPs helping service a lot of clients and a large caseload.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So about taxes, that's a really important point also. So as a 1099 contractor, you will know how much income you earned from the one or several employers that you worked for, but no taxes will be accounted for in that calculation. So again, what happens as you start working, your financial life becomes much more complicated. So it's important to work with a team of professionals. So someone that helps you prepare your taxes is an accountant. And the accountant is someone who can help you determine how much tax you will owe regarding the income that you earned. And what happens as a 1099 contractor, you have no taxes withheld. You just earn the income. So it's important that you know in the back of your mind. And eventually, as you work as a 1099 contractor, you'll have to start setting up quarterly tax payments. You'll have to start setting up a lot of other important things to account for the taxes that are owed. If you're working as a W-2 employee, your employer will withhold some taxes that are due. So they'll withhold some federal income tax. If you live in a state where there's state tax, they'll withhold state tax. And so that's all accounted for in that W-2 statement that's produced. So that's just different factors. It's not necessarily one being better than the other, but just certain things you have to be aware of depending on your employment status.
Mm-hmm. And like one of the things too, you know, as you're talking and just in past experience, it's hard to tell if like it's really a good deal. Like you actually are getting paid more as a 1099 contractor because you do end up having to pay the taxes, your insurance, money towards retirement, money towards savings. So do you have any like easy ways to account for those differences, or is it just do the calculations?
So it's a really good point. And I think one of the benefits, especially right out of school or younger in your career, especially if you're single, is knowing the benefits offered as a W-2 employee. So certain benefits that an employer might offer you are different types of insurance, like health insurance, disability insurance, life insurance. They might help provide materials, assessments, CEU credits. So there's a lot of things that employers will entice you with to come work for them. So even if you're making more per hour as a 1099 contractor, it might be worth it to still be an employee for a lot of those different benefits that they offer. I'm happy, Vanita, you just talked about retirement plans. So the employers can offer retirement plans, one of which is called, a popular one is called a 401k plan. And one of the really important things in a 401k plan is if your employer offers that, they might also offer you something called a match on your 401k. So for instance, if I put $100 a month into my retirement plan and 401k at my employer, and they match 2% of my pay, which also equals $100, they will basically be putting in $100 to the 401k account because you put $100 into the account. So they're matching, that's why it's called the match, they're matching what your contribution is into the plan up to a certain amount. So you can think about it like free money because they're matching you on what your contribution was.
Yeah, that sounds good. I have some questions regarding that.
Sure.
So just like from doing the Dave Ramsey thing and listening to different podcasts, I know there's a difference between like a retirement plan where you're kind of, and this might be with the match in that case, where you're doing it through the business and there's that possibility that if the business ever went bankrupt, like you would lose your 401k versus doing it with like a Roth IRA outside of that business. So what is your tips on that?
Great question. So any contributions you make into the 401k belong to you. Anything that's matched by the employer might be subject to certain requirements in order to access that money. So a typical requirement might be something called a vesting period. So the employer might say, we'll match 2% of your annual contributions But if you leave the company before 5 years of employment, you forfeit the vesting amount, but you get to keep what you put in. Mm-hmm. So that's when we talked earlier about reading the fine print and knowing the specific regulations and rules that go into your company's retirement plan. Really important to think about that. Another term that you brought up, something called a Roth IRA. So retirement accounts, and again, financial terms, right? Financial jargon.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different financial terms that exist in the retirement space. What we're talking about as a 401k is a specific type of retirement plan. If your employer doesn't offer a 401k plan, or if you're a 1099 contractor, you can open your own types of retirement plans. So one type of retirement plan is called an IRA, an individual retirement account. And the benefit of an IRA, or even the 401k, I should back up a little bit. One of the main reasons why people contribute to an IRA or a 401k is that the money going in counts as a tax deduction for the current calendar year. So for example, if I earned $50,000 in my first year as a CF, but I put $5,000 into either the IRA or the 401k, my taxable income for that year would be $45,000, not $50,000. So you're lowering the amount of tax that you'll have to pay in that calendar year. So that's one advantage of doing a pre-tax retirement account.
Okay. No one's ever explained it like that. So I appreciate you. Everyone that I've spoken to, including financial planners, they're just like, oh, it's pre-tax amount. And I'm like, what does that even mean? But
yeah, so it's I'm sure you've heard the expression, there's no free lunch, right?
Yeah.
So while the money goes into the account pre-tax, once you start taking money out of the account later in life, like in retirement, what's going to happen is you're going to owe tax on the money then.
Okay.
But a key advantage of putting the money in there is that the money, so every time you have an investment, you have to sometimes pay tax or something called the capital gains. If the investment goes up in value, there's all these taxes. We could do a 3-hour podcast on tax, but to try and keep it simple for today, if you have a traditional investment account, you may owe taxes annually on that money as you start earning dividends or capital gains and the stocks or bonds grow in value. In the 401k, that tax also gets deferred out. So you won't have to pay tax on that if you put the money in that account. So that's another advantage of using that type of account.
Okay.
Another type of so we're talking a little bit about the taxes. We talked about IRAs and 401ks. There's another type of retirement account called a Roth IRA. Mm-hmm. And the main advantage of the Roth IRA is that you put money into it with after-tax dollars. So not like the example we were just talking about.
Okay.
If I put $5,000 into the Roth, if I make $50,000 this year and I put $5,000 into my Roth IRA, my taxable income for the year will still be $50,000. But the benefit is that once the money goes in there, you won't have to pay taxes on the appreciation of the money within the Roth IRA. So I guess to summarize, and why it's important to work with an accountant or a financial planner or a financial advisor that knows how the tax situation works with these different types of accounts, is you want to have coordination between all these different accounts. You want to make sure that you're putting an appropriate amount into the 401k or the IRA, an appropriate amount into the Roth IRA. There are certain rules and regulations that if you earn a certain amount of income, you can't qualify for a Roth IRA. So you want to make sure that you know the rules and requirements that go into the different types of accounts.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. So I did not put this on the outline that I sent you, but I think it's really important for people to consider this. Based on your recommendation, when should SLPs, when should anybody start a retirement account?
Great question. And again, back to my original disclosure, everyone's individual situation is their own. But I would say that it's, for most clients that I work with, retirement is an important goal that they want to achieve at some point. And the benefit of starting as young as possible is you get to take advantage of something called compound interest. And what compound interest is essentially interest is money earned on existing money. So if I put $100 into the bank and the bank pays me 1% interest, I'll earn $1, 1% on that $100. But what happens is over time, if you earn compound interest, if I earn another 1% the next year on my balance of 101, I won't have $102, I'll have 102 and change, like 102 and 2 cents. So what's happening is if you can think about a graph or a curve, and this is probably giving you bad flashbacks back to statistics class or some of those other classes, but if you can picture a chart with time on the x-axis and value on the y-axis, sometimes we'll call that a hockey stick chart. So it's not linear. It doesn't look like a line. Over time, that interest and the value of the account will grow, not linearly, but exponentially. It will just continue to grow more and more and more. So by leaving an investment alone for long periods of time, years or even decades, it will just compound the gains and allow that money to increase significantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And 1% isn't like the typical, I mean, that's if you're putting it in your savings account, but like things we were talking about, like the Roth, the 401k, the IRA, like those interest rates tend to be higher, correct?
Correct. So the short version of investments is there's a whole spectrum of how someone can invest their money within one of these accounts. So for instance, you can just contribute the money and leave it in cash and you can earn whatever the standard interest rate is in the market.
Like you what can is also, it
now? Right now, I would say, so we were talking about those high interest rate accounts right now. As of recording today, I would say you can get anywhere between 1.5% to 2% on one of those accounts.
Okay.
And if you invest, so thinking on the spectrum of different investments that go into one of these accounts, you can invest in something called a stock. So a stock is purchasing share or ownership in a large publicly traded company. So think about your large companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, right? These large companies. Mm-hmm. What's happening with that is once you purchase a share of stock, it's the most volatile type of investment because the it can go up a lot in one day or it can go down a lot in one day. But over the long run, what we know from studying the markets is that it will give you the largest return on your money in the long run. So it's possible for in a calendar year, it's possible for a stock to go up 50% or down 50%. That's not unreasonable. So knowing the goal of a specific type of investment account is really important about aligning it with what instruments go into the account. So if we're talking about retirement accounts, if someone's 30 years old, you can't access the money in a retirement account without paying penalty until you're 59 and a half. So that's going to give you almost 30 years to grow the money. So we'll often work with clients to probably take a little bit more risk and in an account that they know they're not going to touch for 20 or 30 years because you can deal with those ups and downs in the market. If you, on the opposite side, if you had just a traditional investment account and you were saving that money for a down payment on your house, you should not have any money in the stock market of that account. Because like I mentioned, it's possible for the stock market to drop 30, 40, 50% in a given year. So if you need that down payment for your house, the stock market has a negative return basically 3 out of every 4 years. And so if you land on that wrong year, all of a sudden you don't have the down payment for your house. So one of the important things is to know, we talked a lot right now talking about retirement accounts, but other goals-based accounts like a down payment for a house, paying off student loans, saving for a child's education, there's going to be different investment strategies, or the financial jargony term is asset allocation. So the amount of stocks you own, the amount of bonds you own, the amount of cash you own in those accounts based on what the goals of those accounts are.
That makes sense. Perfect. Well, that was a lot, but I think it was super helpful. And I think you explained it in the easiest way possible for at least myself to understand. So I appreciate that.
Well, that's the most important part, right? So I think it's important to keep things at a very, very high level, especially when you're learning these type of of things. I think in 2019, there's so much good information available to consumers about these things. You just have to be cognizant of where you're getting that information from and making sure that you understand it. And if you have questions, to seek out someone who has the education and the experience to go into more details, because any of these topics that we've talked about so far can be talked about in much greater length and detail.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I agree. You have to figure out like what works for you and your family. But I think that just having this information presented will help people be more informed and make those decisions. Like even as like a business owner, I could certainly, let's give Pinterest for example, I could certainly do all of my own pinning and Pinterest covers, but it's much easier for me to get someone else to do it because they're an expert in that area. So this just gives people the, you know, the starting point, and then help them, you know, to help them make the decision about how they'd like to proceed.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to wrap up with some kind of getting to know you questions. And since you are like the financial guru, I wanted to know your top podcasts and books that you recommend for anybody that's wanting to learn more.
Yeah, great question. So one podcast that I listen to weekly, it's called Animal Spirits with Michael and Ben. And they're two personal finance writers who talk about the markets and just life in general. And they talk about some really important topics. They talk about things that are going on in the market at current times, just other recommendations and things like that. So that's on my weekly queue of things to listen to, but I always get a good nugget or two from them. And I will say that there are so many good blogs and podcasts out there in which personal finance writers are talking about kind of the things we talked about today. So I think if you make a concerted effort to add one financial podcast to your list, or one blog to your list, I think it can help leaps and bounds with just your own financial education, because I think that's the most important thing. I think people need to just learn more about these specific topics that we talked about today. Unfortunately, you can't acquire all that information in a short podcast or one article or one book. But if you just start adding that to your, if you drive to work, just popping on a podcast and downloading it, or setting up for an RSS feed of some of these blogs, I think there's a lot of good information out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you did suggest a book earlier. What was the name of that book again?
Yeah, so the book is called Mom and Dad, We Really Need to Talk.
Okay.
And it's written by Cameron Huddleston. And again, it's something that I've read. I have no relationship with Cameron, but it was just really well written. I actually heard about it on another podcast, in which they were being interviewed. And so it's just, that's how you start hearing all these different ideas, right? And if you pick up a book and pick up a few topics or conversation starters, it makes the conversation much easier to do. And at the same point, I've had some clients that have said to me, that's been the most valuable thing I've provided to them. It wasn't anything like picking an investment or things like that. It was just how to have these conversations and these important topics that people know need to happen, but it can be uncomfortable or awkward if you're not prepared or even know how to approach it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. And my last question is, what is it like being married to an SLP? Now we get to hear the other side.
Oh my God. So it's funny in the intro that you said, that I'm the first male to be interviewed on the podcast.
Yeah.
I think it's so funny because whenever I go to the conferences, I try and seek out other men because I know that it's about 95% SLPs are female, or some really, really high number like that.
It's like 90%,
so I always, yeah. So I always seek them out and be like, oh, wow, there are men in this profession. And so what's it like being married to an SLP? I think it's a phenomenal field. I think that, I mean, I can go upstairs right now, and when we're talking about the assessments and materials and games, I have closets full of all of these things. So we never have a shortage of board games or game night in the house. That's
true.
That's for sure. But I know how important it is. It's Honestly, before I met my wife, I didn't even know what a speech language pathologist was. And the work that all of you do is so important. And the community that you all exist within is phenomenal. And it's one of the reasons why I've devoted my career to working with the community. I think there's so many great resources like yours, Vanita. Like we listen to your podcast, we download it. There are other podcasts that exist. There's, you know, Facebook groups that exist. It's just, it's such a giving profession and it's such a noble profession that it's, I can tell within like 30 seconds now of knowing whether someone is an SLP or not, because they seem to have a lot of similar attributes to my wife and they're all extremely positive. You're all very caring, nurturing people. You all seem to love learning. I think that's really important, which is why I'm happy to provide some of that information I did earlier. It's just, you all acquire knowledge and you love using it and figuring it all out. It's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. So this has been really, really helpful, really informative. And I know people are going to want to learn more. So where can everyone find and connect with you?
Yeah. So you can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can just look my name up, Craig Goldslager. I am on Instagram also at C Goldslager, or you can check out my website, my firm's website. It's utterlyfinancial.com. And what we do on our social is we try and post some of these articles that I was referencing. So a lot of good, just personal finance articles or things that we find of value to the people that we work with. So if you just follow us, you'll start seeing some articles, and maybe that's a good way for some of the listeners to start finding some new blogs or podcasts or websites. And like I said, there's so much information out there and we just like to help contribute to it.
Absolutely. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing your knowledge and being the first male guest of Speechy Side Up. What an honor.
Yeah, it really was. This is great. I can, maybe you'll send me like a plaque and I'll hang it in my office.
Definitely. Well, thanks again, Craig. Tell Lauren I said hi and congratulations on your new baby coming soon.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Have a good night.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. Before we go, I wanted to see if you like listening to these episodes every week. Do you want to keep hearing from these awesome guests? And do you love that you can learn the helpful resources and tips for free? My editor, aka my sister, and I spend a lot of time every week putting these episodes together so that they can be ready for you on Wednesday mornings. We would love it so much if you would take a screenshot of this episode and share it on social media or leave a positive review. And guess what? Every month, I will choose one reviewer to win a little thank you gift. You can choose from a product in my TPT store, an AAC coaching call, or a gift card. It's the least I can do to show how much I appreciate your support. It's because of you that this podcast keeps going.